with millions of tiny nerve endings. These nerves connect to the narwhal's brain through a network of tiny tubes in the tooth. The scientists believe that the narwhal used the sensitive tusks to detect changes in temperature, salt content, and flow patterns in the environment around them. But since only males grow tusks, it's likely that the tusks did not evolve primarily as a sensory organ. More research is needed to really understand why narwhals have tusks and how they use them.
Still, that's one impressive incisor.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
We're on the web at amomentofscience.org. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
It's 2:41 in sports. Tiger Woods will speak to the media Friday for the first time since revelations about his infidelities. Woods is to speak Friday morning from the clubhouse at the TPC Sawgrass, headquarters of the PGA Tour in Florida. The news conference will occur during the middle of the Accenture Match Play Championship, one of the sponsors that dropped Woods. Woods' agent says the media will be limited. Mark McGwire's first day on the job ended with another apology for using steroids. The St. Louis Cardinals' new batting coach got time in the batting cage with hitters today, sat in on a lengthy staff meeting, and then spoke with reporters at the team's spring training complex in Florida. He again said he was sorry, echoing remarks he made last month when he admitted he used performance-enhancing drugs during his time as baseball's home run king in the 1990s. The Chicago Cubs haven't yet held their first official workout of spring training, but a bunch of Cubs were on hand today in Mesa, Arizona, taking grounders, limbering up, and working on their batting strokes. The Cubs are determined to bounce back from a disappointing 2009 season that followed back-to-back Central Division titles. This is the final season in a four-year contract for both Ted Lilly and manager Lou Piniella. The first practice is scheduled for tomorrow. The entire squad is expected next week. The Cubs are under new ownership and are looking for their first World Series title since 1908. Meanwhile, the Office of Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig is opposing legislation to build a new spring training facility for the Cubs. An Arizona attorney hired by Selig's office says a proposal to create a surcharge on tickets to all Phoenix area spring training games is unfair. Attorney Pat Ray made his comments during a legislative committee hearing this morning. The legislation proposed by Phoenix Republican Representative John McComish would add a $1 surcharge on auto rentals and an 8% surcharge on tickets to spring training games played in Maricopa County, which includes the entire Phoenix area. The Cubs turned down an offer to move to Florida, choosing to continue training in Arizona if the state and the city of Mesa can come up with an $84 million plan to build them a new stadium, or that's rather $84 million to build them a new stadium. The Chicago Bulls look for a sweep of their home-and-home series against the New York Knicks when the two teams tip off tonight at Madison Square Garden. And Northwestern goes for its 18th win of the season tonight at home against Penn State. That's sports.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines, and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
It's 2:45. Farmers are finding they can make more money selling crops for energy than for food. A third of all corn grown in the U.S. is turned into ethanol. It's tough to balance the need for energy and food when millions around the world die from starvation each year. Still, farmers are reconsidering their roles, including farmers in Germany. In the second part of our three-part series on biofuels in Europe, Sadie Babbitts meets with one German farmer who wants to make the switch and become an energy farmer.
Erhard Taylor jokes a lot about being an organic farmer. It's about all he can do, because his situation is pretty bad.
My corn harvest from 2 years ago is still lying down on the farm, so it's not sold on the market.
It's hard to imagine. We're outside Ludwigsfelde, not too far from Berlin. Taylor's land looks green and healthy, not bad for late fall. But looks can be deceiving. Taylor says he's lost money for the past 3 years. He blames his land and a volatile world market.
Then my wife comes and asks, where do we go from here? The piggy bank is empty. All the money's gone.
Taylor says he can make more money selling his organic corn and rye for energy instead of food. He's not joking around. There's a growing movement in Germany to get farmers like Taylor to set aside some of their land to grow grains just for energy. There are now areas throughout the country developing so-called bioenergy regions. The idea is that a community, like Ludwigsfelde, would produce its energy locally. Farmers, like Taylor, would sell their grains and manure to a regional bioenergy power plant. Those materials would get turned into green energy. The 20,000 residents who live here wouldn't have to rely on fossil fuels, and they cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. Sounds promising. But Taylor says he'd build his own plant if he had $3 million. Then he could keep all the profits from selling the energy.
I need an uncle in America with 2 million euros.
Euros, like...
Good luck.
Other farmers, though, are cashing in, finding money in, well, poop. A cow chews her cud as an automatic machine does the milking. This milking parlor is part of an agricultural training center here in West Central Germany. This is the greenest farm I've been on. There's a bioenergy power plant, wind turbines, and solar arrays. Klaus Wagner helps run the center. He says this cow's manure is more valuable than the milk, and that just seems wrong to him.
That can't be.
Wagner sees a growing rivalry between dairy farmers who want to sell milk and those who just want to sell manure for biogas.
I guess that the milk production on the one side and the energy production on the other side belongs together. And those farmers who built 3 years, 4 years ago also a biogas plant, they earn really money now. The biogas plant substitutes the milking production.
Wagner says it cannot be one or the other. It should be both, milk and manure, because we need food and energy. It really comes down to a question of sustainability. In the long run, if farmers concentrate only on products for energy instead of food, that will impact the food supply and eventually what we pay at the grocery store. For the Environment Report, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Tomorrow, in the final part in our series on biofuels in Europe, we'll visit a village that is powered entirely by bioenergy. In many older cities, some neighborhoods are known for their abandoned houses. Many of them will decay beyond repair and end up as debris in landfills. Emma Jacobs takes us to one hard-hit neighborhood where one house has become a laboratory for green construction.
Last year, at age 20, Megan McNally bought a house.
This is the front room. This is going to be the bathroom. Doesn't look like much now. It'll get there.
Not just any house. She wanted to find a project in this neighborhood to tie to the environmental science she studied during the year. While home from college for a summer, McNally had been working with a nonprofit, Buffalo Reuse. It works in a neighborhood of East Buffalo with rows of abandoned homes. She paid $3,800 at the city's foreclosure auction for a small wood frame house that had been vacant for 3 years.
I really wanted to help some effort in Buffalo, and so I was trying to brainstorm, and I sat down with Michael, and we sort of came up with this idea of buying a house.
Michael is Michael Grainer, who runs Buffalo Reuse. We make a run for coffee, and he explains to me that this neighborhood is part of a city whose population has shrunk by half.
What we're trying to do is build kind of a base of projects that are undergoing some kind of transformation, and also lots that are undergoing a transformation.
McNally's house looks like it's in good shape, but it's taken a lot of abuse.
On the outside, it looks really great. You can move in tomorrow. But as I came in here the first weekend, it was leaks that people didn't take care of. This floor we had to cut out because it was like all rotted from the black mold.
McNally had no prior knowledge of home repair, so transforming this house soon escalated as she found she would be replacing the plumbing and heating. But in some ways, she's also found her lack of experience to be an asset in recruiting help. Ken Hicks is helping to measure out a part for a radiator in the front room. He turned up near dusk one day last winter. McNally was under the house checking the foundation, and Hicks, a construction worker, was helping out the owner next door. He saw her feet sticking out from underneath, and when she crawled out, they started talking.
It was a big joke, you know. We went back and forth, and I said, you know, it was so weird to see you in that situation, in that predicament. And we just started from there.
Slow work during a down economy means Hicks spends more time on volunteer jobs. He's become one of the main people McNally turns to with questions about plumbing and carpentry.
Being really young, you can ask a lot of stupid questions, and people go, oh man, this girl, but then go on and like answer it in a way that maybe they wouldn't be so open with somebody else.
Anything that you can possibly do wrong has been done in this house, but all those things that I'm talking about are now corrected, and there's so much more knowledge here.
There's still months of work left, but McNally knows she will be living here soon. She's learned both a lot of construction skills and also a lot about teaching herself. She holds workshops to help the neighbors who are left take on their own properties. Her house, still unfinished, is a good training ground for beginners. McNally also realized people are less afraid to approach her with their questions than the experts she first had teaching.
It's hard putting things together, and I don't know, there's been times when you just want to sit down and you get so frustrated that you don't know how to do something, that I think it's really important to have people there who say, whatever, it's okay, and it's okay that you don't know everything, because once you figure it out, or if you ask questions, or if you just do it and hope that things work out for the best, they usually do.
For the Environment Report, I'm Emma Jacobs.
Renewable energy groups are calling on the federal government to do more to support their industries. They want the government to set standards for where the country gets its power. Mark Brush reports.
The groups say they want the federal government to tell power companies that more power has to come from renewable energy. Most power companies in the country are basically regulated monopolies. Denise Bode is the president of the American Wind Energy Association. She used to work as a public utility regulator. Bode says it's up to the government to ask one question when they regulate these monopolies.
What's in the public interest? And, you know, oftentimes as a state public utility commissioner, I would make the determination as to what kind of power generation that we would authorize our utilities to do and what was in the public interest.
Bode says it is in the public interest to get more power from cleaner, renewable sources. Some big utilities oppose having one federal standard, and there are a lot of reasons why they oppose it. But one of them is that the states are already handling it. There are 30 states that have some kind of renewable targets in place. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
Volkswagen has a new car. The prototype was shown at the Frankfurt Motor Show a few months ago that will get an estimated 170 miles per gallon of gasoline. But NPR's Robert Krolwich says, VW, prepare to be humbled.
No question, 170 miles per gallon. That's a huge engineering achievement. But as the blues singer Muddy Waters could tell those oh-so-proud German engineers,
sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
You can get even better mileage from, of all things, a bee.
Sail on.
We're talking here about an ordinary honeybee.
Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
Because when it comes to miles per gallon, bees turn out to be better than the latest Volkswagen, or better than any car ever made. I learned that from Steve Buckman. He studies bees at the University of Arizona.
If you could introduce me as the international coordinator for the Pollinator Partnership.
I can do that, but I want to make sure, since you like bees so much, that you don't hate cars, because that would be unfair.
No, I like cars.
Okay, good. So it's your scientific contention, then, that a bee can take a unit of fuel and do more with it than a car.
Yeah, exactly. It's the ultimate hybrid mini vehicle.
Partly because muscles, all animal muscles, are superb converters of energy. And you know, cars, even the best cars, how they get warm when the engine's on? Well, when you feel that warmth on the hood...
I mean, that is losing a huge, huge amount of heat. But in the case of the bee, this is not losing nearly as much. So far more of the fuel is getting into the propulsion to beat those wings and drive the bee through the air.
Oh, so they're pretty efficient.
So they're pretty efficient.
Sail on!
Okay, so to calculate what we're going to call bee miles per gallon, what I gather you do is you take a bee and you give it all the honey it could possibly drink, and then you attach it to some kind of a pole.
Oh yeah, you can actually tether a bee onto a piece of wood or a little wire, and then
you don't think it's hurting the bee particularly.
No.
And how do you get it to fly?
Yeah, sometimes you need to blow on them a little bit, so give them a little experience of wind in their hair, you know.
Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
So this tethered bee is going round and round and round a device which measures the distance as the bee flies. So you watch.
And let them fly till they run out of gas, till they can't fly anymore.
But now you know how far a bee can go on a tummy's worth of fuel, so you can multiply and figure out how far it goes on a gallon. And it turns out bees are good.
Bees are amazing creatures.
So if you were to give a bee a whole gallon of honey, how many miles could that bee fly?
4,704,280 miles per gallon.
Did you just say 4,704,280 miles per gallon?
Yes, I did. Try that in the home automobile.
I hear a lot of buzzing.
Oh, come on. Aren't you just playing with the numbers here? Because is it the bee? Isn't it that the bee is very little, or is it really that the bee is that good?
We are playing with the numbers a little bit in terms of the scaling factors, but honeybees are far more efficient than any kind of internal combustion engine that, you know, humankind has ever devised. So if you want to think in terms of miles per gallon, no denying it. We've got almost 5 million miles per gallon. Pretty darn impressive.
And we just thought the folks at Volkswagen should know. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Earth and Sky.
I was kind of baptized into this planet world when we designed our exhibits here in New York City at the American Museum of Natural History exactly 10 years ago.
You're listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson of that museum and the PBS series Nova Science Now. He's talking about the museum exhibit that helped launch the debate a decade ago over Pluto.
And what we found was that researchers were discovering new objects in the outer solar system. Objects that were small, like Pluto, icy, like Pluto, with